This is 90.9 FM WDCB and WDCB HD1, Glen Ellen. Welcome to our second hour of The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And I'm very excited to have a special guest all the way in from New Orleans, Louisiana, part of a royalty, I should say, American royalty of jazz, the first family of jazz, Jason Marcellus.
Good evening.
Welcome to The Real Deal.
It's good to be here.
Oh, man, I'm honored. Last time I saw you, I saw you playing with your dad in New Orleans, and I think it was nice outside, and I just said, man, nice set. You said, yeah, man, thank you. Carrying your own vibes to the car. Shouldn't you have, like, roadies by now, man?
Not really. I mean, no. I mean, I could have them, maybe, but I just prefer to handle the instrument myself. It is a monster of an instrument to handle, believe me, but yeah. Sometimes I just prefer it myself.
Wow. First of all, because, I mean, everybody knows your brother, everybody knows you, everyone knows your dad. You know, what is it like creating your own voice in the midst of all this, in the midst of your family?
It's a lot of fun, I must say. I've always enjoyed exploring music, no matter what it is. I've always enjoyed exploring it and learning from music, even if it's music that I don't understand, which that has happened. I've heard music that I don't understand, and I immediately decide that I must understand it, and it has to happen. So I always enjoy exploring music, and so I feel that that enables me to give me more insight into my own music and gives me more options to create what it is that I want to do as a musician.
Right, yeah. When I watch you play, you are intense. I mean, the audience can literally feel the music as you're playing it.
I would hope so. I mean, music is an intense thing. When taken very seriously and on the highest level, it's a very serious and intense activity. And so I think it is very important that the audience feels the music.
Right, all right. So where are you in the spectrum as far as your brothers? You're the youngest?
Yeah, I'm the youngest, the last one.
The last one?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Are you spoiled?
I don't know. In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. It just depends. It depends on the situation.
Wow. So growing up, you know, most big brothers, you know, it's kind of like, give their little brother a noogie on the head. So did you, like, I'm just sure that happened too, but did you jam together? Were they always looking back saying, oh, man, do it this way?
Oh, yeah, there was a bit of that. Even though growing up was interesting for me because really my first four brothers were actually out of the house by the time I was 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
Because I was born so late in the spectrum, which that's another story. But I was born a lot later, so... you know, like you have Branford, Wenton, Ellis III, and Delfio in that order. And then there's Mboya, who's actually mentally handicapped, who still lives with my parents. Oh. And I'm the last one. And by the time I was 6 years old, the first four were actually gone.
Oh, okay.
And so I would still see them from time to time. Delfio I saw probably the most because I think he'd come to New Orleans in the summer. And also in 89 when I was in high school, he was actually, the year in 89, I was in middle school, high school, he actually lived in New Orleans, and we played a lot together.
Okay.
I mean, I played a lot with him and a lot with my father.
Okay.
Now, Wenton and Branford was more sporadic.
Okay.
I mean, I had played with them, but it was not as often. Mm-hmm. There was a few shows that I did with them, but it was just very sporadic, you know, because they were busy and I was in school and so forth. But really, when I was growing up, really, Mboya was in the house. And, you know, I was sort of honestly into my own world listening to a lot of music, especially when I got to high school. That's really what I was doing.
Right.
It was a different situation. So, but I'd say it was a good life. So I don't know if I'd say privileged, but it was good.
That's good. So who were your first influence? Well, first of all, I should ask, your main instrument, do you consider to be drums or vibes?
I'd say percussion, really.
Okay.
I think right now, as a leader, my main instrument has been vibraphone.
Right.
As a leader, I've been doing a lot of that. I still do plan to do some band leading on the drums. There's still music that I've written that I haven't recorded yet. And I will get to that eventually. But right now, as a leader, I'm really focused on the vibes because it's a group that's growing and there's repertoire. And so I'd say as a leader, my main instrument is on vibes. But I think as a sideman, I'd have to say drums.
Awesome.
As the main instrument. I mean, I do some projects on vibes as a sideman with people, but I've been doing a lot of work with pianist Marcus Roberts and my father, Ellis Marcellus, and also people like tenor saxophonist Stephen Riley and John Ellis. And I've done a lot of work on drums with those people. So
yes,
that's the best answer I can give.
That's excellent. So who were your earlier influences?
Let's see. On the drums, I would have to say Philly Joe Jones and Max Roach, Art Blakey, and then Elvin Jones, Tony Williams, and Jeff Tane Watts. Nice. In terms of the drummers that I was first hearing and first really studying. Yeah. And as time went on, I started to get into other drummers, you know, because I was interested in knowledge. So it's like, well, let's see. I haven't checked out enough Roy Haynes. Let me do that. Here's a record, Out of the Afternoon. Put that on. And let's see. Oh, Ed Blackwell. I haven't really checked out enough of him. Let's hear some more Ornette Coleman records. And it's just on and on and on. I mean, we could go on for the next hour and just talk. You know, I mean, I haven't even gotten to Warren Baby Dodge, you know, the drummer that played with Louis Armstrong.
Going back.
And I've been influenced by him. Papa Joe Jones, you know. There's a lot of drummers I've been influenced by. Uh-huh.
So what is your approach then? So, you know, like you mentioned Ed Blackwell. So when you listen to it, what is your approach when you sit down and say, inspire me?
Well, the first thing is I listen for the sound, because all of those drummers had a great sound, and I'm trying to emulate that sound and combine it with my sound. And then there's rhythmic ideas that were creative rhythmic ideas and memorable rhythmic ideas that I'm trying to use, and then try to figure out how to solo in that vein and what other rhythms can I play that are also memorable rhythmically as well. And then there's how they swing. Like, how does Ed Blackwell play his ride pattern compared to how Billy Higgins plays his ride pattern compared to how Elvin plays his ride pattern? You get the picture.
I know.
You know, how is Papa Joe Jones swinging this? How is, you know, a drummer like Sonny Greer, how are they swinging this? How can I have that reference in what it is that I'm trying to do? So even if I'm playing something more modern, I can bring that into the frame, if you will.
Exactly. And that's something a lot of students don't understand, that, you know, they say swing and they kind of put it in one little package. But swing is actually personality.
Swing is personality and belief also, and the energy that you put into the music. Unfortunately, right now, what's happening with the music in terms of the element of swing, it's not as strong as it has been for a lot of reasons. One is that the swing rhythm isn't used in pop music as it had been in the past. That's one thing. And I mean, even in the 60s, like, even, you know, I don't even have to go as far back as Louis Jordan or Little Richard or Chuck Berry. I mean, even if you look at the 60s, and even if you're talking about the music of the Beatles and the Beach Boys, and, you know, even some of those groups around that time would use swing rhythms in their music. And when you get to the 70s, it was a lot more, you know, funk beats, rock beats, but you didn't hear as much swing. And so the 80s, it started to come around a little bit, but the 90s, it just sort of dropped from view. And I think a lot of people view music in terms of, I guess, pop culture, in terms of whatever the popular thing is.
Exactly.
And because swing isn't one of the popular rhythms, a lot of sort of younger musicians won't really investigate it. And so they view it as something that's old.
Right.
You know, so, oh, that's old. That's not really relevant anymore. But they have a pop culture view, not a musical knowledge view. Like, this is something that's great, that's been around, and that can help my playing. And so now the jazz scene in New York, that their whole thing is all about, we want to do something new. Swing is old. That's already been done. We got to do our thing. So they are not doing swing as much, which is unfortunate. I think that musicians are really missing out, and I think that they're actually stunting their development because of it.
Thank you. Wow. When I close my eyes, I'm hearing a very mature, older man. But you're a young man, and you put yourself in the same category. How did you develop these very mature ideas and concepts?
Being around older people.
There you go.
You know, I mean, it's funny when I look back on it, I think that having older parents made a difference. You know, I mean, really, I mean, you know, my mother was 40 when she had me. So, you know, so, you know, I'm 7 years old. My father's 50 years old. So, and I mean, I had utmost respect for him. And, you know, as a father figure and as a musician, I was into his music. And so I think that, you know, those kind of things, I think, sort of, you know, gives you insight into older things. And, you know, my brothers were also successful, and I believed in what they were doing.
Thank you.
And and really, you know, it was just interesting being into, really believing in the jazz music as a kid, because a lot of kids believe in that music, but I did.
Yes.
And so I think that, you know, being around older people and believing in what, you know, some of the things that they believed in, I think is why, you know, some of the things that I play may seem like, you know, I guess a more older seasoned veteran. At least I would hope so.
Right.
That's always been my goal.
That is a goal. Man, what a nice goal to have. That's something that needs to be taught. And I'm glad you're here talking about it, because that's what we're going to spread the gospel on. So, you know, let's break for some music. And earlier you mentioned a piece recorded by the Marsalis family from the album, what's it called? Music?
Redeems.
Redeems. And Charlie Parker.
Yes.
Donna Lee.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here's Donna Lee by the Marcellus Family, and we're talking on The Real Deal with Jason Marcellus. Here's Donna Lee.
We'll be right back.
90.9 FM WDCB. This is Orbert Davis and The Real Deal. And I'm very honored to be sitting across the table from Jason Marcellus. And just in a few minutes of time, he's already developed this conversation away from the strong roots of his family to him as an individual. And it's very important. He's got a lot to say. Are you presently living in New Orleans?
That is correct.
Wow. So not going to New York?
No. I've got some issues with New York,
uh-oh,
actually.
Uh-oh.
Not the city itself and okay. Not the people of the city, but the perceptions of the jazz scene. And the best way I can explain it is that the New York that my brothers went to back in 1979, 1980 is mm-hmm. gone. It is something different. There is a jazz scene, but it's something different. And I must be honest is that I've had some discussions and some slight disagreements. Some people kind of view New York as being the same place. And, oh, this is the Mecca of the music and blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. I'm like, not really. Mm-hmm. It may be still the Mecca of other things, but jazz, not exactly.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, the thing about it is that, when Wynton and Branford first got there, one, New Orleans was a very regional scene. There wasn't much going on. In fact, Wynton wanted to get out as soon as possible. And I can understand that because, there was some traditional music. And, I mean, honestly, a lot of the median age at that time was like 80, really.
Oh, man.
You had a few younger guys, maybe 40, 50, but it was really mostly older guys. And there wasn't a big modern scene, and it was a very regional scene. In order for Wynton to get his career going, he had to go to New York. He had to do that. If you want to play with Art Blakey or go to Juilliard or play with Herbie Hancock, you have to go to New York to do that. And that's how he was able to get ahead the way that he did going to that city. And the same goes with him and Branford. And so I've talked to my father about, he remembers different times that he's been with Wynton, and they went to see, the Milt Jackson playing with Ray Brown. And one time Wynton called my father and said, man, I'm in this hotel lobby and Stan Getz is killing, and, all these great musicians and so forth that were around. And so now by the time I came of age, and I'm just going to say in the year of 1989, we moved back to New Orleans. And from 86 to 89, my father moved to Richmond, Virginia, and taught at Virginia Commonwealth University for 3 years. And there was no jazz scene there, nothing. I mean, the VCU had jazz students, but that was it. There was
so
no
jazz
scene.
He was the jazz scene.
If that. I mean, he didn't really play a lot in the city. I mean, some, but not often. Mm-hmm. And so when we came back to New Orleans in 89, a lot of things changed. He developed the program at the University of New Orleans. So now you have all these young 20-something guys coming into the city playing.
Right.
And also the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts had a serious student body of musicians that are playing now, such as Nicholas Payton and Abram Wilson, who's now living in the UK making records, and Mark Bro, who plays with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and Mark Chad, all great trumpet players, and the drummer Adonis Rose, and there's a bass player Jason Stewart. I mean, these kids could play. They're not kids, but they were in high school at the time, and they could play. So you have all these young people in the city. It was sort of like a boom, if you will, that was going on. And now, my father's starting to work every week at Snug again, but now you're having these tourists come in town, and so the city's starting to get more recognition. There was a record that my father had made in the 1960s called Monkey Puzzle that had been reissued to CD, and that's starting to get recognized. It was like this boom that was going on.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And meanwhile, New York was definitely great, but there was a warning sign. And the warning sign was that in a short span of about 2 years, and I need to research exactly when, but Art Blakey, Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan all passed away.
Right.
In a short span of time.
It was,
And I didn't really notice it, but in a way it was saying, hey, these legends are going to be gone. It was kind of a warning. I didn't know that, but in a way that was the message being sent, like, hey, they're not going to be around much longer.
Right.
And by the time you get to 2000, a lot of them were gone. And, even what was really sad, it was, everybody's time comes.
Yeah,
but,
it's life. Yeah.
But I remember my father and I, we did a record called An Open Letter to Thelonious, and we had this list, and it was like, we'd like to, dedicate this record to musicians who have passed. And it was like this long list, and before we even finished the list, Oscar Peterson and Max Roach passed.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, I don't believe this, man. Wow. This is, you know, I mean, you know, they were up there in age, and but it let me know that, like, that scene that my brothers went to in New York, a lot of that's gone.
Right.
And so, you know, you have that going on. And at the same time, the scene in New Orleans was sort of picking up.
Right.
Now you have, like, guys that tour and go on the road a lot more than they did. And even the traditional jazz scene is a lot younger scene now. The median age is more like 45, 50.
Okay.
And, in fact, I'm actually on that scene myself, to be honest. But, I mean, a lot of things changed. And I think one of the things that changed about New York is that you don't have as many of the legends, many of the veterans that are around. Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, to be very honest, to me, a lot of the jazz scene is like an unsupervised playground.
Oh, wow.
You have a lot of younger guys that go up there, and there's not a lot of the leadership and guidance. And so basically, they just do whatever it is that they want to do. So if you have musicians that aren't dealing with swing, oh, well, okay, we just won't do that. Or you're doing what? Straight feel and 7/8? Okay, fine.
Right.
What, rock, bass, music? All right, fine. I mean, all of that should be brought into the fold. But what happens is a lot of other things just aren't dealt with because either you have younger guys that didn't get the experience to play with musicians that played, you know, standards or bebop tunes or things of that nature. And so now you have a lot of guys that, I mean, really, when I listen to a lot of the newer records, it's hard to find swing. It's really hard to find. It really is. I mean, I could name about 20 records and there won't be any swing on it at all. And a lot of that is just that those veterans just aren't around. So the younger people are like, well, all right, we'll just do our thing.
Do our thing. Have you had a chance to notice kind of the temperature of other cities in terms of jazz and, you know, the movement that you're saying is lacking in New York? Have you seen this kind of arising in other places?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've seen it for a long time, actually.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, around 2000, being in New Orleans, you had a younger crop of musicians that came in from Houston, Texas, for example. And the only issue that I had was that there was a lot about the history that they didn't know. They just weren't taught this. And unfortunately for them, the scene in that city was not too kind to those guys. And for me, that's just such a strange thing because New Orleans, it's always been supportive to the young people.
Right.
Like you had a gentleman who worked at the club Snug Harbor named George Brumette, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. One of the things that amazed my father about George Brumette was the fact that the very first gig I did at Snug Harbor as a band leader, I was, I think, 14 or 15 years old, and George paid us. Father's like, man, he paid y'all. And
I like that concept.
Yeah, and the guys I had were like NOCA students and I think one college student. And but, I mean, that city's always been supportive to the young talent. And I mean, honestly, that city, I saw like the opposite. It was very unfortunate to see. And so you had these students that didn't know a lot about the history. So the question wouldn't be, do you know a Ben Webster solo? It's like, have you ever heard of Ben Webster? In some cases, the answer is no.
That's a
Have you heard a Duke Ellington record?
Tragedy.
No. And so they weren't being taught a lot of these things. They weren't being passed on. And so, but yet they had their own concepts and own things, which was, I mean, that's okay. But a lot of the history was just missing from the music.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I saw it for a while. And unfortunately, that's just where we are. And it's going to take a lot of work. It can be done, but it's just a lot of work to get more of the students into, you know, the history, not throwing away the ideas they're bringing in,
of course,
but appreciating a lot of the other elements that the music has to offer.
Wow. I appreciate your vision because and your optimism, too. That's incredible. Let's play something from a disc of yours as a leader. This would be Offbeat Personality. The disc is Music Update.
Yes.
All right. Set us up.
This is a tune that I wrote that utilizes offbeats that are found in old sort of rhythm and blues records or old blues records, you know. But I use it in a more abstract modern concept,
goodness.
A more modern context. So I decided to call this tune Offbeat Personality.
All right. And it's right here on The Real Deal, 90.9 FM, WDCB. Hey, that was Offbeat Personality. Man, how you feel, everybody out there? You okay? That was cool. Jason Marcellus, our special guest here on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And we're having an incredible conversation. And I'm just amazed at Jason's maturity in terms of not only understanding history, but thirsting for history and setting the record straight and also encouraging many young people to discover history. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right. So what do you see for the future then?
Future for me?
Yeah, let's say future for you first. Yeah.
Yeah, for the future for me, I'm just going to continue playing. One, I'm trying to really develop my own voice on the vibraphones. I mean, there's a lot that I have to develop in terms of sort of language and technique, but I'll just keep at it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be learning a lot more of Lionel Hampton's music and solos and more of Milt Jackson's music and the Modern Jazz Quartet, for example. And what I have been doing and what I'm going to keep doing is to play music that they perform but do it in a different way,
yeah.
in a more modern setting. Sometimes I may take MJQ arrangements or pieces by their pianist and musical director, John Lewis, and change some things up, maybe do some different grooves. There's a lot of different things that can be done with that music
yes.
rather than just play the same things that they did.
Right.
So,
not a repertory band, right?
Yeah, exactly. No. Yeah. So with Vibes... I'm going to keep doing that and also writing my own music. And there's a sound that the group that I have has, and I'd like to develop that sound. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I'd like to make some more records as a leader on drums. And hopefully, if I'm lucky, I can actually do both every 6 months, nice. If I'm lucky. And at some point, start to bring more and more percussion into the fold.
Awesome. How... much influence has Latin music had in your career?
A good bit. The first exposure, really, that I got in terms of real exposure.
Yeah.
I mean, I had heard a lot of African music as a kid, things mm-hmm. on the radio or TV and so forth. But mm-hmm. the first time that I actually really got into some of the details of the rhythms was when I actually got together and had a practice session with the great drummer Jeff Tane Watts.
Oh.
And it was fabulous because it was at a point where I was getting stronger, but there was more information than I needed as a musician. And we talked about listening to people like Papa Joe Jones, and also he talked about Frankie Dunlop, who played with Monk and mm-hmm. so forth. And he also talked about checking out Afro-Cuban music and how the rhythms were organized and set up, listening to people like, he talked about, the Tito Puente sessions from RCA or a band like, I think it was Jerry Gonzalez and the Fort Apache Band. They dealt with a lot of sort of Afro-Cuban and modern jazz kinds of things.
Right.
And interestingly enough, this was actually before the musicians from Panama and the Dominican Republic, Danilo Perez and David Sanchez, actually started to make their mark. They were just arriving, and they made some great records as mm-hmm. Over the next few years. But
this
is like as they were getting started. But anyway, he had talked about just learning these rhythms and how it would help as a musician, and so that was my real first exposure to it. I didn't really get to play that music more consistently until I received a phone call from a good trumpet player friend of mine from New Orleans. Both of us went to NOCA at the same time, named Irvin Mayfield. What was interesting, he called me and says, yeah, I want to do this gig with you and with percussionist Bill Summers. Can you make it? I said, yes, I can do that. And then I asked him, well, have you been over to Bill Summers' house? Because what was actually happening before this gig was there was two percussionists that I started to get together with. One was Bill Summers, and we worked a lot on the sort of these batat practices. You know, and batat drumming is a religious drumming ritual from Cuba. He would have a lot of that in his house, and I would sort of check that out and absorb that information. He's one gentleman I was working with, and another gentleman was named Curtis Pierre, who led a group called Casa Samba, which deals with Brazilian music.
Nice.
So I just remember the fall of 97, I was just beginning to get together with these guys because I knew, okay, I need to explore this Brazilian music and Afro-Cuban music. And I remember in January of 98, that's when we did our first show, and I said, well, I just told Irvin, you need to go to his house, check that out. And that's when I started to play, I really would say world music, because I did that show, and then not long after that, I think Casa Samba, which was really more of a drum group with the Brazilian dancers, we marched the Endymion Parade for Mardi Gras. And so, you know, I was really getting in. That was the time that I was really getting into sort of both musics. And they've had a lot of influence on me, just rhythmically and also just in terms of understanding and interpreting groove.
Wow. Well, you know, there's an underlying theme as I listen to you talk, and it's mentoring. It's obvious there's been some intense mentoring going on in your development. Are you a part of the process of mentoring young musicians right now?
Yes, I try to. And a lot of that influence honestly comes from my father.
Okay.
My father has for a long time talked about the importance of education and the importance of passing on the music. And we've had various discussions through the years, too numerous to even remember. But the long and short of it is the details are always about, you know, how he wants to make sure students have the right information, because a lot of times they don't have the right information. And there's, you know, he always talks about people that know there's something to know and people that don't know that there's something to know. And lots of them. But he's always, you know, wanted to make sure really that the music not only gets out to the people, but that it gets educated and that people understand how it is that it's supposed to be played just the vast history behind it. And so that's something that we've had many discussions about through the years.
Well, you know you're blessed, don't you?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I will say, earlier I said that that I had a good life, but I wouldn't say that I've had a privileged life. But I will say that I was definitely a privileged musician.
Exactly.
I will not deny that for one bit.
Yeah, because you're learning straight from the source, and that comes with encouragement as well.
Yes.
So tell us about some of the students that you're encouraging and you're mentoring.
Well, right now, the guys in my group actually are they're maybe a few years younger than me.
Really?
I actually first met these gentlemen, the drummer David Potter, bassist Will Goblin, and pianist Austin Johnson. They're actually on the Music Update CD.
Okay.
And I first met them at Florida State University. I was doing a residency with pianist Marcus Roberts, who I play drums with. And Marcus had started doing a lot of outreach programs for high schools and elementary schools, and we would get together on how should we present their information, what is it that these kids can get. And so I remember when we did the very first residency at Florida State, you know, we heard the combos playing, we'd listen to them, and we would just give them advice on how should they best approach the music and so forth, and just trying to help the students with learning how to play, because it's a hard environment to learn how to play this music now.
Yes.
You know, not that the music is easy to play, but it's just a harder environment to learn the music.
In what way? Tell me about that.
Well, in the sense that you're not going to get any support from pop music at all. Mm. What I mean by that is that in my father's generation, you know, you had songs that would have, say, tenor solos over blueses.
Right.
So on a jazz tune, it's a blues. It's almost like flipping a switch in a way.
Mm.
Or even in my brother's days, and I'm a little jealous of this, being a drummer, they were around, you know, during the funk era when you had bands like Parliament and Kool and the Gang, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and music like Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Curtis Mayfield. Now, they were around when that music was popular.
Popular music, right.
And they were actually a part of a funk band scene that was high school kids.
Right.
I mean, they were in high school when that music was popular, and they actually would play school dances.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there were these different bands that would play. And, I mean, a lot of them, in fact, Terrence Blanchard was a part of that, too. In fact, I did a gig at the Dakota Club in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Right. And ironically enough, across the street at Orchestra Hall was a double bill with Terrence Blanchard and older brother Bradford. And so after the gig, they came and hung out.
Yeah.
And so there was they were hanging out. And so there's this woman who comes up to Bradford and says, "I remember you back in the days when you was with the Creators." I said, "Oh, man." I said, "All right." And I knew, like, okay, a lot of cats are going to start getting isolated. Man.
Right, right.
Because then Terrence and Bradford started talking about those days.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they, you know, you had high school bands that were playing. And sadly, by the time, even when Delphio was in high school, a lot of that just dried up.
Right.
I mean, you know, bands were replaced with DJs.
And groups that had three singers. That was the thing.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, exactly.
And a machine.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, by the time I came along, it was even worse. Because at that point, you had, you know, the rap thing, which some records were better than others. But I think musically it really fell short because the kids in my generation, unbeknownst to them, were listening to the music of Parliament being sampled by people, by the likes of Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre and Tupac and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be listening to these samples from Zapp and bands like, what's that band? Slave. Yes,
Slave,
that is correct. Yeah. Slave.
Yeah.
But stuff that would be sampled, you know, they'd be singing these lines and, you know, from a Snoop Dogg song. I'm like, no, that's Slave, actually. It's a song called Watching You.
Thank you.
Yeah. None of this is
go by, right?
Yeah, like no MC Hammer. No, that's Rick James.
That's Rick James.
So
forget me nots. You know, Patrice Rushen.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a big hit for Will Smith.
It was. Yeah, like, that's a Patrice Rushen song.
Yeah, you know,
I think Gerald Albright played the solo on that. But anyway, but all I'm saying is that when I came along, you know, they didn't have that.
Yeah.
There weren't any bands to play at dances, and so the groove in music suffers.
Right.
And that's the same thing that happened to jazz. Jazz was a dance music.
Yes.
And that's why the groove was so much stronger, because you either had to swing or you got fired.
Get out.
Yep. None of this relative, I'm trying to do my thing, and I'm trying to do something different and new, and I'm none of these innovation talking points that musicians have now.
Right.
You either swung or you got fired. That was it. And so, you know, playing for dances, whether you're playing swing or whether you're playing funk, you know, when you're playing for dances, and I've been lucky to randomly play for a few dances off and on.
Okay.
It makes a difference.
That's right.
Because when you got people that's moving and grooving and shaking their thing, it does something with the music.
They're part of the band.
Yeah, I mean, and it drives the groove, because you got to groove harder to make them happy, but then they're inspiring you.
At the same time.
And so in high school, that wasn't going on anymore, man. The dancers, you had DJs doing dances. And so that's why I was a little jealous of them, that they got to experience that and I didn't. Unfortunately, it was me having to practice James Brown records at the drums, you know, or, you know, Parliament records at the drums. But I mean, I managed to do all right, but still, I'm still a little jealous.
I'll call your brothers for you, say, "Hey, guys, get together for Jason's sake and just get the old bands together."
Yeah, good luck. That would be fun, though.
Well, it'd be a closed-door session. You know? No one will know about it. Well, you know, there's a movement now that people are saying that if we incorporate jazz with current hip-hop, it will save the music. What do you think about that?
Not exactly. Let's see, how do I even explain this? I would have to be honest and say that the whole hip-hop jazz thing was a scam.
Oh.
And here's why.
All right, listen up, folks.
Here's why. Because, okay, when rap first started, jazz was not on the radar at all. You had guys, you know, sampling a lot of 70s funk, and nobody was saying hip-hop funk. No one was doing that. No one was saying hip-hop R&B. It was just rap, and that was it.
Mm.
Then all of a sudden, and I'm not sure what spurned it, jazz started to come in the mix. Now, you had guys like the group Gangstar, you know, the rapper Guru and the DJ Premier, who's a really good DJ, has great ears.
Yeah.
You know, they started sampling jazz records, but at some point, and I don't know how this happened, you know, there's certain individuals who I'm not going to name started comparing rap to jazz, which is not a fair comparison at all.
Okay.
I think for neither music, because one, you're sort of saying that rap can't really stand on its own, so let's compare it to this other music that's been around for 60 years. Wow. And then again, you're in a way diminishing the accomplishments of people like Charlie Parker and John Coltrane that had serious practice hours, you know, on their instruments. And so it's just not a fair comparison for either side. But then all of a sudden, I started to hear the term hip-hop jazz. Mm-hmm. I'm like, really? And it was just, you know, rappers started sampling jazz records. Right. Now, what was interesting to me was when I started to see actual jazz incorporated to hip-hop, not as many people were interested in that. Hmm. That's why I say scam. Okay. All of a sudden, folks aren't really into that. Well, there's too much jazz there. What happened to hip-hop jazz? Well, I mean, it wasn't really honest. Okay. It was just, you know, my thing is, okay, if you want hip-hop jazz, fine. That means you need a guy that's actually playing that and a guy that's actually rapping or, you know, but really bringing the two things, not just, you know, sampling, you know, some records of Miles Davis or something, which right. you can do that.
Right.
But,
right.
you know, but I think that the, you know, whole thing is, you know, was kind of a scam. Yeah. And to be honest, man, it's funny. I think... To me, this relates to the whole New York thing, okay. how I said that there's people that have a perception of what New York was and still think that that's what it is now. Mm-hmm. The same can be said for rap. Oh, okay. As quiet as it's kept, and I don't think people have been paying attention, but I have. I mean, there are elements of rap that are dying out. Where are the old DJs that used to deal with different scratches? You know, I remember, okay. remember a good friend of mine that would talk about, I think it was DJ Jazzy Jeff did the Transformer scratch. Where are they?
Okay.
Where are the rappers that knew how to freestyle? Where's that? You know, the rappers that knew how to flow. Where'd that go? Because honestly, rap has been very degraded. And okay. I have to be honest, my hometown kind of helped. I apologize. I'm serious. When I was okay. in high school, I really was not into the New Orleans rap at all. It just it wasn't. I mean, you had a few rappers who had skill, but honestly, a lot of them, I'm just being frank, a lot okay. of them didn't. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the rap thing that I respect, you know, I respect groups like Public Enemy or Tribe Called Quest or Leaders of the New School or, you know, or, I mean, honestly, even somebody like an Eminem, someone that can actually write lyrics right. and really flow and really just go at it. And you don't have as much of that going on. I mean, here's some trivia. Could you name 20 rap groups now?
You're talking to the wrong person.
Okay. Well, let's go back to 1990. Could you name 20 rap groups? The answer is yes.
Okay.
Easily. Anybody could have named 20 because there was bunches of them out there. Now, not so much. Mm-hmm. And I think people remember how successful rap was and think that that's still going on.
Okay.
And it's not. Not on that level. I mean, there's some rap that's popular, but not how it used to be.
Okay.
I mean, I'm saying... Rap swept the world in the 90s, right. and I was in high school and saw it.
Yes.
And that's not what it is now. It's
okay, just, so what? How do you see the future? Well, two things, future of rap and the future of jazz.
Yeah, so I was saying all of those things to say that the reason why I don't feel that that's the answer, I mean, the only thing that will really save the music, honestly, is when you address the things that connect with regular people.
Mm.
You know, such as blues or such as groove or just regular folk music that's about the average non-trained musician.
Thank you.
The big problem with the music right now, other than the fact that the majority of the musicians playing are selfish, the big problem right now is that a lot of musicians get into their own isolated world. And they get into, we have to do something new and we have to do our thing and we have to innovate and we have to. So then that's why you get a lot of music with these odd metered structures that no average person cares about. And the only people that care about it are other college students.
Oh.
You know, they're the only ones that care about it. And they get to listen to someone playing these complex fourths on their saxophone that's boring and uninteresting that only students understand. And the average person then decides to beat themselves up and think, well, I don't understand this, and maybe it's my fault.
Mm.
It's not your fault. It's just not that good.
Oh, man. Because, or they'll just turn it off and turn away from it.
Yeah. So some of them, no, they'd be wise to do that. But unfortunately, you do have those people that kind of go along and,
yeah.
oh, you know, well, we like this because it's intellectual. No, you're liking it for the wrong reason.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, what'll save the music really is just, you know, connecting with things that the average person understands. Like nice. The average person can feel a swing rhythm. They actually can get that.
Right.
Or a blues or just simple things.
Right.
Now, like I said, those complex things are a part of the music.
Yes.
But it's dangerous when you make it the music.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. So right. I think the future that will really help the music is connecting those things. Now, I think as far as hip-hop is concerned, those elements have been brought in and should be brought into the music. I mean, it should mm-hmm. happen. I mean, sure. you know, even on when I did, an open letter to Thelonious, a record with my father, I even told my father, like, man, I got this idea for this monk tune, Tail, man. Huh? We could have a hip-hop vibe on it, you know, because the tune is like a funk tune. So we could play it like, you know, the tune was like, pop, 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 that's a funk tune, man. Boom. Uh-huh. I was like, you know, hip hop neo soul, man. We ought to do that. So those are going to be brought into the music.
Yeah. What did, you, what did your dad myself. Say? Your dad say, "Let's do it."
Yeah. Oh, he loved it, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, but see, the thing about my father that not a lot of folks know per se is that he's somebody that has always checked out everything that is going on.
Yes.
And is always aware of all of the music that is happening, whether it's rock music, whether it's rap music, whether it's hip-hop music, where no matter what it is. In fact, I'll tell you a little story mm-hmm. that really illustrates this point. And this is something that's not very well known. He was on a gig. He was actually seeing a gig at, I think it was at the, I want to say the Playboy Club in New Orleans. It was mm-hmm. like the late 60s. And so there was a drummer on this gig that gave this band 2 weeks notice and said, yeah, I'm just giving y'all 2 weeks notice to say, you know, I'm leaving the group. And they were like, so what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to form this band, you know, and it's going to be a funk band, but we're going to bring in elements of jazz and, you know, Latin music and all that. And the guys thought that he was crazy. They didn't think, man, you're not going to do that. Trio was Ramsey Lewis, and the drummer was Maurice White, and the band was Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Okay.
And my father is actually a big fan of Earth, Wind, and Fire's music.
Yes.
I think because he had that personal connection, but also there was a lot of jazz influence with their music in terms of like the harmony and the chord changes and so forth. But I mean, he like knows Earth, Wind songs and Stevie Wonder songs. And so, I mean, he's aware of all. I mean, that's kind of where I get some of that from.
That's awesome, man.
You know, and that's one awesome. Other quick story that I'll tell. We were watching something on TV, and there was a singer that was singing a pop song, and it was like a jazz piano player. And my father watches and says, see the way he's playing that, man. See, that's not really right, man. See, when you're playing pop songs, you have to rearrange the triads in a certain kind of way. But, man, you know, all those sevens and nines, that's all wrong. But I'm saying he's somebody that, you know, appreciates any music and is about playing it correctly, awesome. No matter what it is. So he was like, okay, yeah, that's great. Yeah, let's do that. So all I'm saying is those things are going to be brought into music, and they should be brought into the music.
Excellent.
And so forth. But I don't think it should be this contrived attempt to, we need to reach out to young people.
Yeah.
No, we need to teach young people. Oh, I think that young people have been dumbed down enough and have been degraded enough, and I think that we need to stop taking their money. Because quite frankly, when I think the parents made a big mistake by giving teens money, stop doing it. Just that's enough. I think we've done it long enough, and we need to cut it out.
Oh, man, I'm going to let my kids hear this.
Because what then happens is you then have big corporations such as the Disney Channel catering all of their programming to these young teens, and they decide to hide their older things. I was very lucky to be a kid to have access to any of the old shows whenever I want, whether... I mean, you'd see an old cartoon or a new cartoon or an old rerun from any era. I was very lucky to be able to just see TV and, you know, see either Steamboat Willie, old Mickey Mouse, or some new show.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, Disney, they have these focus group meetings and have meetings on how can we make $15 million more dollars than we made the last quarter. Mm. Like, well, okay, let's make sure we never show the old cartoons ever. Or if we do, we'll show it for 5 minutes and we'll overdub a new soundtrack on it. But let's make sure we don't show that, and we'll just show teenagers all day, 24 hours a day, except for the three-hour block where we have things for three-year-old kids.
Right.
But other than that, we'll show teens all day. But see, that's when you cater to them. That's enough. We need to stop doing it.
Yeah.
The kids need to be educated.
There you go. Last week, I sat with my five-year-old, and we had 2 hours of Underdog.
Oh, yes. Underdog is here.
That's right.
Definitely.
There's no need to fear. Well, with Jason Marcellus, there's no need to fear the future of this music. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your insights, Jason. And glad to meet you and know you as a friend now. You're a friend to the real deal. And we'll definitely have you back sometime. And hopefully we'll get to play together sometime.
Thank you very much. All right. It's been a pleasure.
Before we go, Jason, I want to play something from your CD, Music in Motion.
Wow, that's going back in the day.
Yeah, it's going back. This is funny. A young man sitting across from me saying this is going back in the day.
Well, it is, like 10 years.
Well, man, this is a smoking track. This is called There's a Thing Called Rhythm. All right.
Oh, yeah. There's a story behind that title.
Okay, tell it.
Yeah. Let's see. How do I not? Oh, well, I'll implicate him anyway. There was a tune that was written for the Los Hombres Calientes record, and I will say that one of the band members was having a little trouble with the charts, and I was getting very agitated and upset, and I was saying how he didn't have any rhythm and that you have guys that want to play eighth notes all day and play boring stuff, but when it comes to syncopated rhythms, they have trouble. Okay. He said, there's a thing called rhythm. You can't forget about it. So that's where that title comes from.
All right. Well, here it is. There's a thing called rhythm. This is Jason Marsalis on The Real Deal.